It's a familiar story. A former area of the Soviet Union tries to pursue independence from Moscow, and soon Russian tanks are rolling across its borders and killing civilians by the thousands. No, not Ukraine nor Georgia, but Chechnya, a tiny nation in the Caucasus whose long struggle with Russia was filled with war crimes and atrocities. Today, on A Day in History, we look at the atrocities committed as Russia tried to keep control of this fiercely independent people. The Chechens themselves are mostly Muslim, with a distinct culture that made them a target for persecution throughout history. Stalin had deported and killed hundreds of thousands of them. So, when the time came to throw off the communists, Chechnya was eager for it. They declared independence in 1991, under the leadership of Dzhokhar Dudayev, just as the Soviet Union was unraveling everywhere. But the new post-communist government did not recognize their claim. Still, Moscow was too distracted with establishing the new Russia to bother with little Chechnya. That was until 1994. Tired of Chechnya's insubordination, President Boris Yeltsin funded and supported an anti-separatist Chechen militia to overthrow Dudayev's separatist government. It failed spectacularly. The Chechenian separatists proved overwhelmingly loyal to Dudayev, and his forces crushed the coup and captured Russian soldiers embedded in the groups. Embarrassed, Yeltsin decided full military intervention was needed, and on November 30th signed Presidential Decree 2137 to, quote, re-establish law and order in the Chechen Republic. The conflicts that followed consumed thousands of lives over the next 20 years. The First Chechen War began on December 11, 1994, when Russian troops crossed into the region. The Russians opened with a powerful aerial bombing campaign and a three-pronged ground invasion aimed at the capital city of Grozny. In what would become a pattern for Russian invasions of neighboring countries, Russia assumed that its overwhelming numbers and firepower would crush their opponents in days, but they were badly mistaken. Ambushes and scattered resistance en route to Grozny slowed the Russians down, but it was only a taste of what was to come when the attack on the city began in earnest on December 31st. The Chechens had turned the city into a fortress, sandbagging buildings, constructing defensive lines, and slipping reinforcements in through the gaps in the Russian blockade. The unprepared Russian soldiers marched into a meat grinder. Bitter street-to-street fighting, mines-laden streets, and a seemingly endless web of RPG and machine gun positions tore the Russians apart. Casualties were immense. The 1st Battalion of the 131st Independent Motor Rifle Brigade, for example, lost half of its men on the first day. However, Russia had a brutal solution. If the city was a problem to fight through, they would simply remove the city. Throughout January, Russia obliterated Grozny with aerial bombardment and artillery strikes. Thousands of civilians were killed indiscriminately. A journalist within Grozny at the time recalled scenes at a hospital when a doctor, having just pulled a sheet off the lifeless face of a young boy, turned to him, shaking, and shouted, "How can they do this? How can they, bombing women and children every damn day?" Russia finally claimed control of the ruins of Grozny on January 19th. Most of the city's buildings had been damaged or destroyed, and around 35,000 civilians were dead. Yeltsin declared the war complete, but the Chechens had plenty of fight left in them, and the war was only going to get grimmer. Fighting continued in the countryside for months, and sporadic attacks in cities kept the Russians on constant alert. As Russian soldiers tried to root out the Chechnya forces among the native populations, the Chechnya civilians quickly found themselves as victims of an angry, frustrated, and resentful Russian military. Russia began what it called Zakitska, or cleansing operations across the country. Technically, they were supposed to root out the insurgents, but inevitably, their victims were largely civilians. The symbol of this brutality was a Samarskyi massacre in early April 1995. After the Russians identified a small group of insurgents in the village, eyewitness accounts suggest they were most likely locals who were defending their home from the incoming Russians and not actually part of the separatist militia. The Russians surrounded the village with tanks and armored personnel carriers. They fired into the village randomly for hours and killed or wounded dozens of people. Soldiers prodded at the village, which only made the impromptu village defenders fire back. The village elders pleaded with their besiegers to stop attacking them. They insisted they were only firing back to defend themselves and that they wanted nothing to do with the war. Eventually, on April 6th, the Russian commander gave them a choice: surrender exactly 264 rifles, 2 machine guns, and an armored personnel carrier by 7 a.m. the next day, and the Russians would spare the village. The village elders were confused and surprised. There weren't 264 weapons in the village, and they'd need more than 24 hours to calm everything down. The Russians replied that the terms were final, and they'd be entering the village the next day. How much of it they destroyed was up to the villagers. The unreasonable offer had been a lie. Russian artillery and bombers opened fire on the village that night, ignoring the terms of the offer. The following day, Russian troops and armored vehicles entered the village. Officially, the Russian soldiers encountered 300 armed Chechen separatists, who they defeated after a day of intense fighting. In reality, they encountered no more than 40 local men, armed for no greater reason than defending their homes and families. Eyewitness accounts from residents, journalists, and human rights groups described Russian soldiers firing indiscriminately at buildings. They threw grenades into basements to kill people hiding in them. Tanks rolled down the streets, firing haphazardly at houses with no thought to whoever was inside. One survivor said that what they did to us here is something you shouldn't even do to livestock. The evidence from the scene was a testament to the truth, even as Russian authorities denied what happened. The remains of people who'd clearly been executed, of buildings burned from within by rampaging soldiers, and the corpses of women and children were more powerful evidence than the rehearsed denials of officials in Moscow. At least 100 people were killed in the massacre. It was the largest, but certainly not the only one of its kind in this phase of cleansing operations. The Russians weren't the only ones to inflict terror on civilians, though. On June 14th, a group of 195 Chechen militiamen infiltrated Russia itself and took almost 2,000 hostages in a hospital in the town of Budyonovsk. Their hostages included children, mothers, and newborns from the maternity ward. They demanded that Russian troops leave Chechnya and peace negotiations should begin, or they'd kill the hostages. The Chechens proved perfectly willing to follow through on their demands and shot 6 the very next day when journalists failed to abide by terms for a meeting. The Russians tried to storm the hospital 3 times and failed. Civilians were caught in the crossfire and the Chechens suffered minimal casualties. Eventually, the government was forced to submit to the demands. They could not withdraw troops so easily, but the Russian government agreed to open peace negotiations and let the militants go. It was yet another embarrassment for Yeltsin's government that destroyed Russian confidence in the war and left almost 150 people dead. The success of the Budyonovs hostage attack inspired other Chechen militants to do the same. A copycat attack by Chechen forces near the Russian airbase at Kizlyar got another 1,000 hostages and provoked another botched rescue attempt. This time, 26 hostages were killed, but the fighting to retrieve them and kill the militants cost the lives of 200 soldiers on either side and destroyed a large portion of the village they were holding up in. By early 1996, the war entered a virtual stalemate. Russia kept control of the cities while the rebels were relatively safe in the countryside. It took the elimination of Chechen leader Dzhokhar Dudayev to shift the course of the war, but not in the way the Russians had hoped. Dudayev was killed by a Russian airstrike after Russian intelligence had picked up his location by a phone signal. Despite being the figurehead of his nation, Dudayev was no military leader and was peripheral to the actual fighting. He was, however, a symbol for the Chechens to rally around. Shortly after his death, the newly energized Chechen forces rallied for a bold attack on Grozny. They hoped that kicking the Russians out of the city would force them to give up. On 6th of August, the Second Battle of Grozny began, and within 3 hours, the Chechens had reclaimed most of the city. It was another Russian humiliation to add to the pile, and the final nail in the coffin for the war effort. Moscow declared a ceasefire on August 31st, and the two sides signed a formal peace treaty in 1997, swearing off further violence. Russia did not recognize Chechnya's official independence, but the region was left functionally independent anyway. The peace failed to address any of the underlying causes of the war. It was never going to last, nor was a unified Chechnya going to last either. The new official Chechen leader, Aslan Maskhadov, ruled mostly in name only, and most of the country was actually under the power of warlords and former resistance commanders whose militias would not stand down. Chechnya itself was in ruins. Russia refused to pay any reparations, and with no jobs, industry, or legal order, many Chechens turned to crime or joined one of the warlord militias across the country. In the vacuum, radical Islamist groups gained a foothold, leading to the rise of jihadist movements. Russia, meanwhile, grew stronger. Its economic and political situation stabilized, and by late 1999, the aging and unpopular Yeltsin had lined up a younger, stronger nationalist successor named Vladimir Putin. For an ardent Russian nationalist like Putin, the failures in Chechnya were an open wound to national pride that could only be healed with victory. In August 1999, 2,000 Islamist Chechen militants crossed into the border region of Dagestan and took weeks of fighting to push back. Moscow approved aerial bombing into Chechnya to strike at the Islamist bases in response. However, there was not enough justification for a full ground invasion, just because one fringe group had attacked a border region. It was perfect timing then when bomb attacks hit apartment blocks across Russia in September, killing almost 300 people, which Russian authorities quickly blamed on Chechen Islamist extremists. Putin could not have hoped for a better time justification for a second Chechen war. The fact that two FSB agents were caught red-handed planting an almost identical bomb at another apartment block in Ryazan was, Russian officials said, nothing more than a training exercise. And as we all know, the Russian government is nothing if not honest. Whether the Chechens planted the bombs or not, Putin acted as if they had. On October 1st, he declared the Chechen government illegitimate and assembled almost 100,000 men for a second invasion. This was not the same Russia nor the same Chechnya that had fought in 1994. The Chechens were torn apart by factional conflict, while the Russians were more cautious and patient than before. As before, Grozny was the Russians' primary target. The Russians encircled the city and bombarded it from afar, starting in mid-October. Missiles, bombs, and shells rained onto the city. a particularly bad wave of missile attacks on October 21st hit homes, hospitals, and mosques, killing or injuring hundreds of people. At least 68 people were killed by a single missile, which landed in a marketplace. In typical fashion, the Russian story changed several times. At first, they said it was an illegal weapons market. Then, that it was a normal market, but no civilians had been there, and that their, quote, special operation had only killed Chechen militants. Putin's explanation was that infighting Chechen militants had fired the missiles at themselves. Even escaping the city was no guarantee of safety. One refugee convoy from the city was stopped and shot at by Russian soldiers on December 3rd, killing at least 40 people. An even larger convoy of refugees was attacked by Russian aircraft outside the village of Sham-Yurt in what international observers later determined to be a deliberate attack. 25 people were killed and around 70 were injured, all of them civilians. The closest thing to an upside was that Grozny's population was much less in 1999 than it had been in 1994. So many had been killed or fled in the previous years that the death toll was lower, although more of the city was destroyed. A UN report on the war dubbed Grozny, quote, the most destroyed city in the world. Bombardment was followed by another tough street fight through January 2000, as the Russians drove out the rebels. Hundreds of civilians were caught in the crossfire or simply murdered by the Russians. The Staropromyslovsky district of Grozny alone saw around 40 to 50 executions of civilians by Russian soldiers. The Russians fared much better in the fighting than they did the first time, and declared the city liberated in early February. Once again, the Chechens melted away into the countryside, and the Russians pursued relentlessly. Russian pacification campaigns were no less brutal the second time around. For example, the village of Komsomolskoye was essentially wiped off the map in March 2000, as Russian forces closed in a Chechen warlord hiding there. Hundreds of Chechen fighters were slain in the fighting. Many others were captured, only to be tortured or mysteriously vanish from Russian captivity. Dozens of civilians were killed in the violence, but many more died in the following months, homeless, starving, and given no aid by Russia or the Chechen separatists. There were the expected massacres by unsupervised soldiers that one finds in every counterinsurgency conflict. 82 civilians were killed in the village of Novye Aldi, for example, abused and executed by Russian soldiers with too much hatred and too little conscience. Along with the murders came other crimes typical of war: looting, arson, and worse for the women and girls. Perhaps the single most horrific episode fell upon the village of Katyr-Yurt. The Russians bombed the village without warning for hours on February 4, 2000. It was later discovered that Russia had deployed vacuum bombs, whose shockwave alone can rupture the lungs of their victims. When the bombardment finally stopped in mid-afternoon, the shell-shocked civilians weren't even given time to gather the remains of their families from the streets. Instead, they were told to pack their things, get in cars or buses, and leave. 2 hours later, a convoy of refugees from the village left, only for Russian jets to suddenly open fire on them. The cars were mangled up like mincemeat, one survivor said. The convoy stretched maybe 3 kilometers. Every car was hit. Another survivor vividly remembered a car full of children being hit, saying, quote, they burned before my eyes. Given the white flags that the civilians had been ordered to display, and the fact that the Russians had ordered the refugee convoy in the first place, calling it a mistake is simply not possible. Many survivors did not even get to bury their loved ones, as the Russians ordered most of the bodies to be burned rather than return them to the families as proof of the crime. Russia has refused to discuss the massacre ever since. And the European Court of Human Rights' extensive investigation into the atrocity has been met with silence in Moscow. Russia's tactics were bloody but successful. The Chechen separatists were routed and reduced to ambushes and terror tactics to oppose the Russians. Chechen militants retaliated with their own attacks on civilians, repeating the hostage crises of the previous war with similarly awful results. On October 23, 2002, 40 Chechen Islamist militants attacked the Dubrovka Theater in Moscow, taking 850 hostages. They demanded the same things that the Budyonovsk hostage takers had squeezed out of Moscow: independence and peace talks. But Putin would not negotiate like the previous government. The crisis ended 3 days later, when elite Spetsnaz operatives fired gas into the theater and stormed it, killing all 40 militants, but also killing 132 of the hostages. A similarly disastrous hostage crisis occurred in September 2004, when Chechen Islamists took over 1,000 hostages from a school in the town of Beslan. Once again, Putin's government refused to negotiate. After a 3-day siege, Russian soldiers stormed the school and fought an intense firefight which killed or captured every militant. However, 300 hostages, mostly children, lost their lives. Russia's military dominance and the alienating actions of the Chechen militants spelled the end of independent Chechnya. By October 2003, Russia had installed Akhmad Kadyrov as president of the non-independent Chechen Republic. Violence decreased significantly, and the separatist movement fizzled out over the following years. Although Kadyrov himself was assassinated by militants in 2004, his son and current president Ramzan Kadyrov remains a staunch Russian ally. Russia's military operation in Chechnya officially ended in April 2009. And while there have been isolated attacks by Chechen separatists since then, the movement for an independent Chechnya is all but dead. The legacy of the Chechen wars is complicated. Russia is not known for transparency, so the number of casualties is only a rough estimate. Anywhere between 70,000 and 200,000 civilians were killed, while 400,000 more became refugees. Combat deaths were in the tens of thousands between the two sides, with estimates generally falling somewhere between 11,000 and 25,000. The political and strategic consequences of the war have shaped Russia and the countries unlucky enough to border it. The Chechen War cemented Putin's strongman persona and secured his position as leader. Furthermore, the denial of legitimate statehood to former Soviet republics, the use of overwhelming military force on civilians, and the denial of atrocities in the face of overwhelming evidence became a model that Russia has repeated in Georgia and Ukraine.